everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of the Mysterious Benedict Society Read Aloud Podcast, Book 4. Today we'll be reading chapter 12, but first a recap of chapter 11. Rennie figured out a clue for Mr. Benedict's message that led him to a hidden box behind a painting in the sitting room. The box had coded instructions on the front that said Sticky should be there to open it. There happened to be some papers in the box, blueprints to be exact, with different color-coded instructions. After a few minutes, the writing disappeared, and that's why Sticky had to be there to see them, so we could memorize it. The children honestly have no idea what these blueprints are or what the color keys are, but they think the last line of Mr. Benedict's message can help them figure it out. Rennie thinks about why Mr. Benedict didn't use pictures to translate the message to Constance, and he believes it was because of the sound. Chapter 12. Frightening Endeavors and Daring Maneuvers. "What took you so long?" asked Kate. She was joking, of course, but Rennie thought it was a good question. Strange that something had hit upon him so easily today had felt so impenetrable yesterday. Sleep and food had made a difference, he knew, but he also knew that there was more to it than that. "What's most surprising to me," Rennie said, "is that Constance didn't solve this herself. She's the one with the perfect sense of rhyme and meter, and we know how she identifies patterns without even trying. For her not to be able to reconstruct the last line of Mr. Benedict's message? Well, I think it shows us better than anything what she's really dealing with. We can't see that battle raging in her head, but it's obviously a fierce one." For a moment they all considered this, all without a pang of sympathy and protectiveness. Nobody was a greater test of their patience than Constance, it was true, but neither was there any person in their lives more remarkable. "So what's the secret, Rennie?" Sticky asked, keeping his voice neutral. He felt mildly resentful, but was determined not to show it. "What do rhyme and meter have to do with this?" "Okay, think of the pattern of the message," Rennie said. "He gave it to us in the form of a poem. Where one who stands defies the name, dare hunt the hunter in his frame, and strike the clinches from their floor." "We didn't get the exact wording of the last line," Rennie continued, "because Constance was distracted, but we can figure it out based on the rhyme and meter." "Rhyming couplets," Sticky said, nodding, "an embiotic terameter. Da-da, 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 da-da. And the last word of the line rhymes with floor." "Door," Kate cried. "Constance said there's a door made out of clay." Rennie tapped his nose. "She also said it was the kind that the French use." "Which makes no sense," Kate said, frowning. "Right," Rennie said. "But think about what we know Constance heard. She obviously heard the words French and door. And based on rhyme and meter, we can guess where those words would appear in the last line. There's a rhyme connection between French and clinch," Sticky observed, "and floor and door." "How about this," Rennie said. "And like the French, we use the clay door." Kate tried it out. "And strike the clinches from their floor, and like the French, use the clay door." "I like it, Rennie," she said. "It seems right. But how is this the answer?" "Because it's all about the sound," exclaimed Sticky, almost leaping from his chair. "Mr. Benedict wasn't talking about a door made out of clay. In French, it sounds like clay door." "Oh," Kate cried, slapping her forehead, for although neither she nor Rennie could compete with Sticky in the language department, they both had studied several and knew a great deal of French. "And like the French, use clay door." "Exactly," Rennie said. "It sounds like the English clay door, but it's actually the French clay door, the gold key." The three friends couldn't help grinning, laughing, and congratulating one another, for even in emergencies, especially in emergencies, it's no small thing to solve a puzzle upon which so much depends. And here was one whose solution determined their course. True, that course was dangerous, but they had this already known. What mattered most was that they find significant information McCracken didn't have. They had an advantage. They had their start. They were on their way. Soon enough, however, celebration turned to deliberation. Sticky pursued the blueprints in his mind's eye, focusing only on the diagrams and notes in gold ink. "It all holds together," he murmured. "The path is fairly clear, even if the obstacles along the way aren't. I think some of the notes aren't going to make sense until we're actually there, like the last line of clay door. Before we found the blueprints, we could never have figured out what it means." "Well, that's great news," Kate said. Sticky looked at her askance. "How is it great news that we're heading into a dangerous situation with the ticking clock counting down to potential disaster without knowing ahead of time how to get through these difficult layers of security?" Kate was already and very speedily clearing the table. "Because it means we can't get moving." Rennie and Sticky jumped to help her, and by working as fast as they could, and even did help her a little. Soon everything was squared away to Kate's satisfaction, and in the meantime the three of them had discussed what their next steps would be. With Sticky monitoring from his computer workstation, Rennie spent some minutes on the radio, obtaining and distributing necessary information. And then it was done. The arrangements had been made. They had their plan. A quick use of intercom system brought Ty Lai bursting into the dining room, where he found Kate and Rennie waiting. Trudging in behind him came a steadily, decidedly grumpy-looking Constance Contraire. "We used the husher to sneak up on Captain Plug," Ty announced with a burst of giggles. "She sprayed coffee out of her mouth like a fountain." Kate gave him a stern look. "I told you we had rules about that, remember?" "But you don't even like the rules." "True," Kate said. She snatched her bucket from Ty, placed it on the floor, and pointed to it. "Nevertheless, have a seat on the red stool, young man." Ty's eyes widened. He looked as if he were about to get a marvelous present. He dropped into the bucket and sat very still, hands on his knees. "Am I being punished?" he asked with a hopeful look. "Severely," Kate replied. Ty covered his mouth to suppress a giggle, then composed himself and made an obvious effort to look unhappy. Constance, meanwhile, had slouched into her easy chair in the corner and drawn up her feet under her. "So you three got it all figured out," she said gloomily. "That's so great." "You did say you wanted us to after all," Rennie said. He hoped that his light tone make a difference in her mood, but Constance only looked coldly at him from behind a veil of scarlet hair. He cleared his throat. "You also said you wanted to move on, and it's time to do that. We all need to pack a small overnight bag. No matter how things go, there's a good chance we won't be back here for a day or two, maybe longer." Ty, who was still enjoying his punishment, raised his hand. Kate gave him a nod of permission, and he asked brightly, "Where are we going? I don't have any other clothes, or a bag, or a toothbrush," he thought for a moment, "or toothpaste." "We're going to help Mr. Benedict," Kate said. "Sticky's going down to the lab right now to make the serum he needs." "We saw George on the stairs," Ty interjected. Kate gave him another stern look, and he clapped his hands over his mouth. "Anyway, we're bringing that serum to Mr. Benedict, and we're going to stop the Tin Men from breaking out Mr. Curtin." Ty whispered, "Wow," behind his hands. "But to do that, we have to get out of town first. We'll explain that part later. Right now, you can change into the clothes you were wearing yesterday. I've already taken them from the fumigator and washed and dried them, and ironed them, and replaced your broken shoelaces." Ty's eyes grew enormous. He raised his hand. "I was up early," Kate said, and he lowered his hand. Rennie turned to Constance. "Will you please help him pack a bag? You're the only one with old clothes here that are small enough to fit him." Constance gave a grudging nod and climbed out of the chair. Despite her unhappy look of reluctance, she was actually moving quickly. It was only by constant force of will that she was managing her anxieties about Mr. Benedict. No matter what required doing right now, Constance would not be a source of delay, not this time. "Let's go, Ty," she snapped as she headed for the door. Ty looked at Kate, who signaled that he could get up. He leaped to his feet. "That was terrible," he exclaimed. He drew the back of hand across his forehead as if in relief. "Can I bring your bucket on the trip?" "Are you kidding? You have to bring the bucket," Kate replied. "What if you misbehave again?" Ten minutes later, Rennie stood in the dining room once more. The lights were off, but morning sunlight streamed pleasantly through the windows. He was wearing his backpack ready to go. The room was very quiet, very still. He wondered how many times he had seen it like this. Not many, for it was not just empty. There are empty rooms, and then there are rooms that feel crowded, corner to corner with absence. Not long ago, in this very room, Rennie and Mr. Benedict had talked about that exact thing Rennie was feeling now. It was after lunch, the dishes had been cleared away, and the others had all excused themselves. Mr. Benedict had decided to enjoy an extra cup of tea before returning to his study, and, no doubt having sensed the hesitation in Rennie's goodbye, invited him to sit and have an extra cup himself. "I know I've spoken to you often about my artist friend Violet," said Mr. Benedict, passing Rennie the honey. "And I know you're familiar with her work. You've told me you admire her paintings in the sitting room, of course. But if I recall correctly, you also spent time with the catalog of her work that I keep in my study." Rennie was stirring honey into his tea. He smiled. "If you've ever failed to recall something correctly, Mr. Benedict, I certainly can't recall the occasion. Yes, this was just before we built the platform. I remember hearing Constance yelling about the leak in the ceiling, how the plaster was peeling, how annoyed she was feeling, just as I finished looking through the catalog." Mr. Benedict tapped his nose. "I recall that we intended to discuss Violet's work further, yet we were understandably sidetracked and never returned the subject." "That's true," Rennie said, sipping his tea. This is not news to him. There were many subjects that they had agreed to discuss at some point, and the list was always growing. They both kept mental track of these bookmarked conversations, and often returned to topics months after they had first been mentioned. "I admired everything I saw in the catalog." "So you said at the time, and I was pleased to hear it. Some of her work does not appear in the catalog, however, and I thought now might be an appropriate time to mention it." Mr. Benedict sat down his teacup and laced his fingers together. When Violet was a child, she lost her brother, and her early artwork reflected her grief in a striking way. She rendered familiar scenes in which one would typically expect to see people, yet the people themselves were missing. "I imagine that made for unsettling effects," Frenny observed. "Indeed," said Mr. Benedict, "and appropriate. Nothing is more unsettling than losing those we've loved. Yet I would propose for your consideration, Rennie, that there is something powerful, even important, in missing them. Missing our loved ones in itself is a connection with them, is it not? Painful, perhaps, but special." Rennie nodded, a little embarrassed. He assumed Mr. Benedict was hitting at Rennie's own worries about missing his friends and family. Indeed, everyone in Mr. Benedict's circle, not least Mr. Benedict himself, if he went away to a university. Rennie had talked about it with Miss Permal, but only a little bit. More than once he'd come close to knocking on Mr. Benedict's study door, only to change his mind and creep away. Now it occurred to him that Mr. Benedict had been aware of those almost knocks. In fact, Mr. Benedict's decision to have an extra cup of tea had likely been meant to make it easier for Rennie to approach him. No need for knocking. Mr. Benedict had removed the door. "When the time comes for you to go away, Rennie," Mr. Benedict said after a pause, "whether that be soon or far down the road, and whether it be for a temporary sojourn or elsewhere, or maybe a permanent relocation." Mr. Benedict's voice faltered slightly. He cleared his throat, and with a small shock, Rennie realized that Mr. Benedict's bright green eyes had tears in them. "When that time comes, my friend, I shall miss you dearly, just as I miss Rhonda, just as I shall miss all the others whose cherished faces I am so accustomed to seeing around this table. Yet who may find it best at some point to leave the table for good?" Mr. Benedict took a handkerchief from his pocket and blew his large, lumpy nose. "But special people tend to go and do special things," he continued, "and one must accept it as best as one can. Whenever I miss old friends, I remind myself that this very act makes them a part of my life. We may be separated by time and distance, and very often by lack of hours to write each other proper letters. But we remain friends, and I remain grateful. Violet, for instance, I haven't seen in years, but I think of her every day, and I take pleasure in knowing she's in the world." Something occurred to Rennie. He was surprised that he had never thought of it before. "The violet you keep on your desk." Mr. Benedict tapped his nose and smiled. Rennie thought of Kate's bucket and spyglass in his chest. He also had a pair of Sticky's old spectacles on his dresser, and he knew that Sticky had given Kate a different pair. She and Rennie had preferred different ones, so it had worked out neatly. What would they remember him by? He wondered. He needed to think of something to give them. Constance, too, of course. Nothing sprang to mind, though, and for some reason Rennie found this troubling. Was it really because he couldn't think of a specific memento? No, he decided, it was because he had never thought of these items as mementos before. Thinking of them in that way made everything all too real. Rennie realized that he had been staring into his teacup. Mr. Benedict was sipping his own tea, politely giving Rennie time with his thoughts. When their eyes met again, Mr. Benedict's expression had shifted slightly. There was a reluctance in it that made Rennie uneasy. What was he about to say? "I've shared these perspectives of mine," Mr. Benedict began, "simply in hope that you may find some of them useful in the days ahead. Perhaps you will, perhaps you won't. My own perspectives are admittedly sometimes strange, but there is one related matter a bit closer to home that I would urge you to address." Suddenly, Rennie understood. Having anticipated Rennie's embarrassment, Mr. Benedict had been trying to help Rennie by talking about himself, but now he was going to offer direct advice without having been asked, and it made him uncomfortable to do so. Mr. Benedict cleared his throat again. "In short, Rennie, if you find yourself missing someone long before you have even decided to part, you should consider the possibility that you are suffering unnecessarily. Sometimes when you've lost something, it won't come back on its own. Sometimes you must attempt to retrieve it. That can be a frightening endeavor, for of course there is always the prospect of failure." Rennie's throat felt tight, and he was having to make an effort not to avert his eyes. He was glad that he did, otherwise he would have missed the sudden twinkle in Mr. Benedict's own eyes. He would have missed the wink. "Of course," Mr. Benedict had said, rising, "there's also the prospect of a success, and you have a rather good record of succeeding, have you not?" Standing alone in the dining room, Rennie found that his eyes had naturally drifted to the chairs in which he and Mr. Benedict had sat that day. He'd been imagining the scene. There had been so many scenes in this room, he thought, from the mundane to the frightening to the wonderful. Though these currently sunlit windows, he had looked out upon windy days and snowy days, sunshine and storms. They all had. Rennie heard Sticky's familiar footsteps in the doorway. Rennie started to turn, but something checked him, and he remained as he was, thumbs hooked in the straps of his backpack, regarding the empty room. After a moment, he heard Sticky walking quietly up beside him. He hadn't needed to turn. Sticky knew that Rennie knew he was there, and he knew that if Rennie had wanted to be left alone, he would have done something different. They had been friends a long time, so Rennie found that he wished he had turned and gestured for Sticky to join him. "It is a really interesting room," Sticky murmured. He adjusted the strap on his own backpack. I can see why you're so fascinated. Rennie smiled and glanced over at him. We've always come back to this table. Every time we've gone and done something dangerous together, we've come back here and sat around this table. And talked about everything that happened, Sticky said, nodding, and enjoyed feeling safe. They stood in silence for a time, taking in this room together. Let's make sure we do that again, Rennie said. The cameras placed by the scaredy cats, meant by leaving Mr. Benedict's house by the front or back door, was out of the question. Thus, in accordance with their plan, Sticky and Rennie found Kate standing near the third floor platform saying goodbye to Madge. The beautiful falcon was perched on Kate's leather glove protected arm, and Kate was stroking her feathers. Kate was wearing her parachute, the better to carry it, while also toting a large duffel bag she had packed, which rested on the floor nearby. Hiding behind Kate was Ty Lai, holding the red bucket up in front of his face like a shield. It's nonsense, Kate was saying to him. You can't listen to what Constance says. But Constance can read her mind, Ty squeaked. Kate turned to Sticky and Rennie with a look of exasperation. Constance is in a fine mood. She told Ty that Madge wants to eat his toes. Maybe she does, Ty cried. He seemed genuinely nervous, but also appeared to be enjoying the dramatic possibility of being hunted by a falcon. Don't be silly, Rennie said. Madge doesn't want to hurt you. Even as he said this, however, he shared a private look with Sticky. Neither of them had ever been entirely certain that Madge didn't want to hurt them. Why would Constance say something like that? Sticky asked. Because I didn't want to wear my shoes, and she said that I had to, and I said I didn't want to, and she said I didn't get to choose. Ty took a breath. You do have to wear your shoes, Sticky said simply, and Ty nodded. Maintaining his balance with some difficulty, he lifted one foot to show that he already had complied. Constance came stalking down the hallway with her backpack on. Rennie started to ask where Ty's bag was, then he thought better of it. Probably she had packed his things in the backpack with hers, and if she hadn't? One glance at her face suggested that the wise course was to let the matter drop. Kate tossed the treat down the long hallway and sent Madge after it. Meanwhile, Captain Plug had come to say goodbye. She hugged them each in turn despite the sullen look on Constance's face. She squeezed the beloved guard rather fiercely, implored them to look as careful as they possibly could, then took the protective glove from Kate, for she had promised to care for Madge until Kate's return. Now don't you worry, Captain Plug said, adjusting the strings on the glove to account for her thick forearms. You know I've taken good care of that sweetheart in the past, and you can be sure I'll do it again. We'll have a lovely time together, won't we, Your Majesty? This last she called down the hallway, then blew Kate's whistle to summon the falcon to her arm. Oh, Madge, we're all sorry you can't come with us, Kate said, as Sticky and Rennie made polite noises of agreement. But that nasty old McCracken remembers you too well. You stay here and be a good girl, okay? You mind, Captain Plug? With that, Kate snatched up her duffel bag and joined the others on the platform. They all waved to Captain Plug and Madge, all except Constance, who was glowering at her shoes. And Kate said, Let's do this the proper way, shall we? Let's not, Constance muttered. Doesn't someone have to stomp on the floor? Ty asked. Come on, Connie girl, Kate prodded. When was the last time we did it together? Constance blew hair out of her eyes. Fine, she said. She glanced down at Ty. She took his hand. Hold on, you. Constance stopped. Rennie stomped. Kate stomped. Sticky stomped. The trap door in the ceiling fell open and they went up. It had been a while since the society had used what Kate liked to refer to as the zipper. The first reason they had stopped using it because number two, once she'd found out about it, had inspected it and deemed it too dangerous. After that happened, the society had secretly made adjustments to address number two's safety concerns. The second reason they had stopped using the zipper was because number two had found out again and inspected it again and declared that the zipper was not safe enough. Unfortunately, their families had all agreed with number two. Take only necessary risks, Kate, Milligan reminded her. And so promises were solicited from the society members not to use the zipper again. Except in case of emergency, Rennie had made sure to say. Number two had narrowed her eyes. Except in case of genuine emergency. And to this they had all reluctantly agreed. Now here they were, accompanied by a little boy firmly secured to Kate's belt by a tether, making use of carefully placed handholds and footholds to climb the roof's north and west cable. Before long, the rooftop patio was a distance below them, and they were peering out over the tree-lined street, and all except Kate felt a nervous fluttering in their bellies. Directly across from them was the Washington's house, a cozy abode that Sticky had had for some years, now called his home across the street. For Mr. Benedict's home was also his home, whose rooftop lay well below their current position, rising vertically from the peak of the Washington's roof, was what had been a decades-old television antenna, the sort that looked like a skinny metal tree stripped of leaves and lower branches, but currently functioned as the society's drop-off point. After confirming that the streets were clear and quiet, Kate opened her duffel bag and removed an oversized crossbow, followed by a grappling hook attached to a coil length of cable. After securing the few end of the cable to a metal bracket in the roof, Kate moved the heavy coil to her opposite side, well out of Ty's reach. She loaded the grappling hook into the crossbow. "Are you going to shoot that?" Ty whispered. He stared at the edge sideways for a better look, but three pairs of hands had a firm grip on him, and he found he couldn't move an inch. He held still. Kate gave him a nod. She shifted her position, raised the crossbow to her shoulder, and took a slow, deep breath. As she exhaled, she squeezed the trigger. There was a sharp twang. The grappling hooks vanished, and the coil of cable beside Kate made a metallic sizzling sound. It seemed to melt away as if by magic before Ty's astonished eyes. And then Kate was yanking back on the crossbow, as if she were wielding a fishing pole and had just landed a big one. Across the street, the grappling hook wound round and round one of the metal projections of the antenna, catching and holding with a distinct clink that set the now taut cable quivering. Kate worked on a small crank attached to the bracelet on the roof, tightening the cable even further. Then she put away the crossbow, took out a rather complicated-looking harness and pulley contraption, and, adjusting the harness to accommodate the parachute on her back, buckled herself in. "Is Kate going to zip across the street?" Ty breathed when he saw her attaching the pulley to the cable. "Kate always goes first," Tiki whispered in reply, "just to be on the safe side in case something goes wrong." "But what would she do if something went wrong?" Stiggy shrugged. "We have no idea. We just know that we'd have to see it to believe it." Kate connected the end of the spool as almost invisible fishing line to the harness and handed the spool to Sticky, who explained to Ty that this was for bringing the harness back. The spool was attached to the reel to make the retrieval easier. Ty studied the reel and looked at Sticky to signal that he understood. When he looked back, Kate was gone. Past the highest branches of the elm tree, she zipped over the tops of the smaller trees along the sidewalk, over the street, over the Washington's front yard, and at last to the drop-off point, where she came to a stop not with a loud bang or clang. The pulley was equipped with special padding, but with more of a satisfying thunk. For a moment, Kate dangled from the antenna, which had been reinforced with much stronger metal and heavy bolts to support the zipper's true function, and they could all see her grinning even from across the street. Then she lowered herself into the rooftop, put down her butt duffel bag, and removed the harness. As Sticky reeled the harness back, he explained to Ty that Kate would now inspect and doubly secure the grappling hook at the end of the cable. "So it is really very safe," he whispered. "There's no need for you to worry." "I'm not worried," Ty whispered. "Can I go next?" "Of course you could go next," Sticky said, and so Ty did, covering his mouth the entire way to keep himself from exclaiming in delight. Kate caught him at the other end, removed him from the harness, and tethered him back to her belt again. Constance went next, then Rennie, and finally Sticky. They had always crossed the street in this exact order, because Kate needed to go first, Constance hated waiting, and Sticky wanted as much time as possible to work up his nerve. Today, however, Sticky went last simply out of tradition. "You did it," Ty whispered when Sticky arrived. He had whispered the same thing to Constance and Rennie. "Let's all stick out our tongues at the camera on the fence, because we tricked it." And so, from the peak of the Sticky's home across the street, the five of them stuck their tongues out at the camera, which could not see them. They had completed their first daring maneuver of the day. There were many more, and much more dangerous ones, to come.